thank you very much for having me this evening, and I shall start with an admission that I've never been to Café Sci Oxford before, but I have been to Café Sci Glasgow, where I did my PhD, as noted by Rachel. So I think I understand the format, but I expect very high standards from the Oxford public. So I'm slightly scared by facing you all, and I hope I'll justify Rachel asking me to do this. So I'm afraid also it is a bit of a hotchpotch talk. I'll admit that now. It's a little bit jack of all trades. So we'll just jump around a bit. But what I was hoping to get is to just briefly set up some different areas that may spark discussion and debate afterwards. So I'm going to kind of maybe slightly rush through some various different topics in the hope that where your interests lie will fit somewhere and that will direct what we talk about later. So, first of all, I want to just... So I just want to take you through briefly the life cycle of malaria. I hope I'm not making this too simple for any of you. And please feel free as well, I'll say at the beginning, just ask questions throughout if you feel like I'm losing you. Do interrupt me, I don't mind at all. I know we have the open discussion at the end, but I don't mind interruptions. So I want to take you through the life cycle because as a parasitologist, we're obsessed with life cycles. That's what we care about. Because life cycles help us work out where we should target our interventions or our control measures. So if you want to combat a disease like malaria, you've got to understand where it needs to go, what it needs to do, where it replicates, where its key points are in its life cycle that should be the most cost-effective area for us to jump in. And we've certainly got quite a long history with malaria of acquired knowledge. So, I'm sure we've got some acquired knowledge in this room as well. How many hosts does malaria need?
I know there's two people in this room who can answer this question, so if there's silence, you have to answer.
Come on,
it's two, isn't it?
Two, perfect, brilliant. So, what are the two hosts?
Us.
Humans? Mosquitoes, brilliant. I promise there's not too much audience interaction. That's pretty much the limit of what I would expect from you. Until the discussion later on. So, it's the anopheles mosquito, because not all species of mosquito transmit malaria. And it's only the female, as Roach pointed out, because only the female needs blood to provide nutrients for her eggs. So it's only the female that sucks blood. And if you'll suspend your disbelief. I know we've got these lovely models over there, but I can't handle them. This is raided from my son's toy box this morning, and for the purposes of the talk, it's a mosquito, and not a female. So, we're just going to briefly take you through the life cycle so that we all are on the same page with where we are on malaria. So, the female mosquito comes along, and I'm terribly sorry, you have got malaria at the moment. So, bad luck, I've just diagnosed you. So, she's going to take some blood. And that parasite that was circulating in your blood has gone into her midguts down here. And it is a bit complex, life cycle, but I'm sure you can keep up with this. The inside the midgut of the female mosquito, in that blood meal, is actually the stage where the parasite undergoes sexual reproduction. So there are male and female parasites. They mate in the midgut. They move through. They are very clever at moving through her body. And eventually, after a period of time, get all the way to the salivary glands. Now that's obviously the crucial place to be, because what that parasite wants to do is get to the next human. So it's found its way, after several days, all the way up to the salivary glands of this mosquito. But in the meantime, the mosquito herself is obviously concerned about replicating her own species, and so she has unfortunately found this rather nice pool of water, and she's laid her eggs in there. So she likes a kind of stagnant-ish pool of water, not free-flowing, so that's just perfect. And so she's laid her eggs, and of course that is also a problem because we then have lots more mosquitoes. But in the meantime, anyway, she's not really bothered, or we assume she's not really bothered about being infected with the parasite. There is some evidence, just as an aside, which I find interesting, that infected mosquitoes have different behaviour to uninfected mosquitoes. So we could, one, imagine a sort of zombie-infected mosquitoes, and then, I need more blood, I need more blood. Because she actually goes for more risky blood-seeking behaviour than an uninfected one. So it's almost like that parasite really is affecting her choices. But anyway, that's an aside. She's laying her eggs, so the parasite's in the salivary glands, and at this point, she comes over here, and I'm sorry, but she then bites you. And at that point, what she does first, which is absolutely crucial to the parasite life cycle, is that she spits before she sucks. And so, those salivary glands where the parasite was pop out first into your blood before she then starts sucking up blood, which is obviously good for her because then she can lay some more eggs. But for the parasite, it's got where it wants to be. It's in the next human host. Now, I'm sorry to say, the parasite is now infecting you, and it runs all the way to the liver cells. It hides there for a couple of weeks, replicates masses of times, and then it pops out of the liver and then recirculates into the blood system, and it lives inside red blood cells, replicating, bursting, lots of times. And that is the stage where you'll get the clinical symptoms. So you wouldn't really know you had malaria, except you know you've been bitten, I guess, and it would itch, for about 2 weeks, and then the clinical symptoms kick in when it's circulating in the bloodstream. And probably you would go and seek medical help at that point. But if you're living in a country where you're bitten all the time with malaria, you grow up being exposed to it time and time again, you acquire a certain level of immunity. And again, this is partly why malaria is so successful, because all those populations in Africa who are living exposed all the way through, if they survive childhood and they don't die of malaria early on, then they acquire immunity. They fight their own battle against the malaria parasite. And they actually don't suffer severe clinical symptoms. So you've got a lot of African adults walking around carrying the malaria parasite and so continuing transmission and transmission. So that is a bit of a whistle stop tour of the life cycle. But what I wanted you to get from that really is the idea of thinking about the crucial points in that life cycle that we can target to break the chain of transmission. I hope all of you would know one of the very simple physical barriers that we could do to prevent transmission. So obviously she's coming along, who's going to bite you. What can we put between you and the mosquito? Bed net. Brilliant. Hopefully some of you probably slept on them. So bed nets are incredibly successful, actually, at just reducing malaria transmission. So they're the physical barrier. You can also, of course, reduce just the numbers of mosquitoes. That, of course, has an effect on your malaria transmission. And there are lots of control measures for that, too, like spraying. But one area for control is also within the human being. So you, infected, would have gone and sought clinical help, hopefully. And at that point, you want to get treated with a drug. But also, if you do get treated, then we stop that cycle for further transmission to anyone else too. So hopefully that's nicely set up as to why we have antimalarial drugs. And briefly, I wasn't going to get too bogged down in the details of the malaria drugs, their names, what they do, although I think maybe we have some chemistry help on that one. But what I wanted you to get from the idea of the drugs timeline is that drugs have transitory effectiveness. All drugs that are working on an evolving organism, like malaria, will only last for the period of time before the parasite becomes resistant to them. And it's the same, of course, for other diseases. These green bars are kind of representing where the drug was first used and then pretty much when it started to fail and we kind of couldn't keep using that drug anymore. So quinine, which has been used for hundreds of years, is from, probably some of you will know, ground up from the bark of a tree, was used when people had fevers, they knew that if they ground up this bark of this tree and drank a tea infusion, then it helped with the fever. So for many years it's been associated with malaria fevers, curing malaria fevers. And it's still used today, in fact, intravenously, for severe malaria cases that come into the clinic. So all the other drugs have come, some have gone already, some are still with us, hopefully, and some lasted a lot longer than others, and that's interesting too. Sulfadoxin pyrimethamine, which is that one in the sort of 1965, came in the late 60s, that really lasted a very short time. In parts of the world, it was introduced, and within a year, there were signs that the parasite was resistant to it already. It was just very quick growth and resistance. And others, like artemisinin, we seem to be using for a long time, and partly the reason why they're doing so well is because we use them in combination. And again, I'm sure this is something you'll have all heard of with other drugs, that if you use multiple drugs in combination, then the chance of the parasite becoming resistant to that combination of drugs is very low. So WHO in 2001 issued guidelines that all first-line treatment for a malaria should be a combination therapy, and that's what that last bar is. It's still just about hanging on. We're seeing some early signs of resistance to the artemisinin drugs now, which is a bit worrying. But anyway, I know this is right now throwing complexity onto this, but again, don't get worried about all the different drugs. Just the concept that, of course, this is true in other fields as well. So you can extend the idea of the transitory nature of drugs that so, work on.
So when you indicate, for example, the tetracycline or penicillin, you know, yeah. bar ends in 1960, mm. people didn't start using it then. But you're saying that resistance first became widespread or became observed at that time.
Right.
It's no longer always successful.
Exactly. So, yeah. As I say, this is true of other diseases where you're working on an evolving organism, effectively. So this is, again, just extending the discussion of drug resistance a little bit. This is a little set of maps overlaid for 1957 to 2006. Which was made by some of the staff members within WARN, where I work now. And the blue is... So the white countries are where malaria exists. And this is by country level. So what she's done is she's coloured in blue where chloroquine resistance is then prevalent across that country. Yellow is another drug, SP. And pink is where you've got both. So I'll just let it play. Hopefully it will work. So basically you can see the year ticking over at the bottom, and you can start to see chloroquine resistance emerged in Southeast Asia, but also in South America, and then SP resistance starts emerging in Southeast Asia again, and then everything starts just going pink everywhere. And by the time we get to 2006, it's pretty pink, basically. There's not many places where you can still use chloroquine or SP. And it's a real shame, because chloroquine is a really well-tolerated drug, very, very cheap, which, of course, are key things for malaria-endemic countries. And anything else that we have as backup is maybe 10 times the cost of chloroquine. So,
it's a shame. Tweaking the original drug, as penicillin has been tweaked.
Right, so one option with drug development is to just sort of think of variations on a theme, right? So the problem is that then resistance comes very quickly to those subsequent drugs, because you're acting on a similar pathway of the parasite, and so the parasite population that exists would very quickly probably get resistant to that new drug. So, yeah, the idea is really what you want is like a brand new drug that parasites never seen before, of course, and then you hope that it's going to last whilst you combine it with other drugs that act on different parts of the parasite. So, that's all justification for constantly making new drugs. And I like this kind of funnel because it gives you, I hope, a real concept of the clinical drug trial process. So I find it quite hard to think of these enormous numbers. So I've got about 10,000 popcorn kernels in this bag, and the idea that you had all of these potential drug compounds in the beginning to, by about 15 years later, get one drug that will actually be used in human beings. So it's an enormous number that you've got to start with in the lab to get down to that one successful one, and it also takes an enormous amount of time. So just to give you an overview of, this is obviously more generic than just in malaria, this is true of all drug development. You have this preclinical phase, so that first phase, which is all based in the lab. For the purposes of malaria, we grow the malaria parasite in, if you like, petri dishes. We have plastic containers, we give it human blood, we keep it at 37 degrees, we fool the parasite. Mostly fool it, sometimes it gets wise and just dies because it knows it's not in a human, but we try and pretend that it's in a human, and then we give it doses of compounds, and that's where you're starting with your 5,000, 10,000 different compounds, and you just keep trying until you find compounds that kill the parasite, and obviously thinking about sort of doses that might actually be usable in a human being at that stage, and then you would go to mouse models. In malaria, we have really good mouse models because there is a mouse malaria. So we can look at a complex mammalian and think about a complex organism and think about what happens with the malaria parasite when a drug is actually involved. I didn't actually know that there were so many different malaria, the malaria affected so many different species until when I was at Glasgow. And we had a call from London Zoo saying that they suspected they had malaria in penguins. And could we advise them on any idea or could we diagnose? And so, yeah, there's a penguin malaria, in fact, which is kind of surprising. But so there's malaria for all sorts. Anyway, there's a mouse malaria. So we use that in the preclinical phase to do a lot of testing around safety. And then anything that gets through that phase moves on to first human trials. So these phases 1, 2, 3 are where you're looking at human volunteer stage. And phase 1 is checking for safety. So all you're doing at this stage is giving small amounts of the potential drug, the compound, to healthy volunteers and seeing how they react. You're not even giving them malaria at this point. And then whatever gets through that stage, you go to phase 2 and you check for efficacy. So at that point, that's where you give the volunteers malaria and then you also give them your compound and see whether it really has the effects that you were hoping it would. And a lot drop out at phase 2, actually. But you're talking about fairly significant numbers as well, so 100 to 500 volunteers for those kind of trials.
But you say drop out, do you mean the drop
out? The volunteers drop out. Well, the volunteers do drop out if they kind of like can decide to stop at any point in the trial if they want to. But no, I meant the compounds drop out, yeah, at that stage. So you're down to, you know, your funnel is getting tighter and tighter at this point. And then, and of course, your cost is piling up now as you're getting further down, so the investment in those last few compounds is getting significant. And then phase 3 is where you just scale up your population that you're testing on. So we're really talking about thousands of volunteers at that point. And you want to see if the findings that you found in those few healthy volunteers, maybe not in the same population that you really are thinking of the ultimate population for the treatment. So, for the example, with malaria, we use healthy undergraduate male students at Oxford to test on. But actually, you know, we're talking about drugs that will need to be used on 5-year-old Tanzanian kid or maybe a pregnant woman in Ghana. And so, obviously, those phase 3 trials have to really start looking at the target population that you want to use the drug on. It may be that they react the same, or it may be not. So you're getting closer to your real life setting, and then you have a little bit of time, 6 months to 2 years, for, I mean, this is FDA, that's the Federal Drug Authority in America, but the same thing exists in Europe and other countries. So you want to license your drug for human use, and that takes quite a bit of time, massive amount of paperwork, and rightly so, a lot of safety data. And so finally you get licensed, and then following that you still collect data. So even after licensing, of course, any time that drug's used in the world, you collect data on safety issues, toxicity, any other adverse reactions that you've found in those patients that's taken it. So we're always collecting on and on and on. And WARN collects data from any anti-malarial clinical trials. Over many years, we have data spanning, I guess our first ones are looking to help, you know, maybe from the 80s, we have some small studies from the 80s, but right up to now, we're trying to monitor and gather as much data from clinical trials on all drugs, malaria drugs, as possible. And then we hold now a repository of about 86,000 patients in that repository that has been given all different antimalarial drugs, and of course that's a pretty powerful resource to then start asking questions, what happens to these patients across all different geographical settings, which you can't actually answer from any individual study. So that's what WARN's about, you know, a little plug about what we do. So if you want to ask more, you can at the end. And again, I know this is a bit busy, but I just want to finish with an overview of where we are with malaria then and drugs. So this gives you, just think about the colours really, not the individual drug names and everything. There's an organisation called Medicines for Malaria Venture, MMV, heavily funded by Bill and Melinda Gates, as are we. And they're about coordinating drug discovery in malaria, so there is a duplication of work going on, but also that we really think about having these blocks at all points in the pathway, so we don't have all our eggs in one basket somewhere, but that we're actually trying to make sure that there's a pipeline where things are coming along all the time. So the yellow section is that really early stage, pre-clinical, pre-human testing. The green is where we're just getting into the first human trials. And then at the far end, the blue, is where we've got new drugs just coming onto the market. So, as I said, that's a bit of a kind of, I feel like I've run through it at breakneck speed. But I thought I'd just throw in all different things in the hope that some of these will be of interest to you, and maybe not all, and then that will just lead us where it leads us with discussion. So I think that's pretty much, ooh, look. So that's WARN, and that's me, and hopefully that's the whistle-stop tour around malaria and drug trials, and we'll have a good discussion after you've refilled your drinks.